fly away from the land because we can, because we can.
Yes, that was Gather by the River by Davell Crawford. And I thought that was appropriate. I have here in the studio, Cow Studio, Louise Vance, the director of the new PBS special, Seneca Falls. Hello, Louise.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for coming in. It's good that you are you're local.
Yes, I've lived in Sebastopol for about 4 years now. And before that, we were living in the Bay Area since the late 80s, my husband and I. So San Francisco, the East Bay a little bit, and then up to Sebastopol.
Good choices.
Yes, it's been a great move.
Indeed. Now, Louise, you know, you are the director of this film, but you've had, you know, quite a storied career up to this point. Perhaps, you know, as in news, as in, I mean, CNN, you were there right when they started.
I was.
So could you give us a little background of how you got into film and news and TV and what inspired you and how did you get into it?
Absolutely. Well, I have an English teaching degree, and there were no teaching jobs back in the late 70s when I got out of college. And I ended up first at an ad agency for a couple of years, and then at an NBC station in Denver. And I was so drawn to documentary filmmaking. They were doing some pretty interesting local docs on the Denver, just the local hometown level. And I worked on several of those, one on prisoners' rights, one on early black settlements in Colorado, both of which fascinated me. And I was there for 4 years, did a lot of public affairs programming, and then heard about CNN starting. So like so many others, I sent in my application, but managed to head down there and bang on the door and get in as one of the first 30 people hired to start CNN.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, so it was really wild. The first day of work, they told me, go in the corner, sit down, and start naming shows. Come up with names for shows. So it was really quite amazing. And Ted Turner at that point didn't really have all the funding in place, and he was trying to sell his station in Charlotte. And he came in one afternoon and said, "We sold the station. You know, we're going to make payroll." And we all said, "Yeah." So we, you know, opened some champagne, and so it was wild and woolly.
Was there any? I love the thing of names. You know, make up some names of shows. What were some of the names which didn't make it?
You just start taking two words and putting them together, you know, and they all sound pretty trite, you know, news night, you know, night news, you know, these kinds of things.
Yeah.
We ended up with the show that I produced first. There was a 2-hour midday show called Take Two, which I think the hosts ended up coming up with that finally. Mm-hmm. But it was a 2-hour show, and it was a husband and wife anchor team. So it was Take Two. But, you know, it was... We were inventing 24-hour news, and so there were lots of hilarious stories and problems that arose with, you know, all kinds of things. And we had a very active president of the network at the time who would run into the control room screaming, take the feed. You didn't even know what he was talking about. And suddenly Charles Manson's face comes up in the middle of the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade. That actually happened because he got denied parole, which he gets denied every year. But, you know, so, you know, there was this hysteria about the fact that we could go live with anything. And we, you know, so we did. But it was
hysteria
great.
On both sides, on all sides.
Yes. But, you know, back then... I was actually proud to work at CNN, and we used to cover the news differently. We used to have a balanced, it sounds like Fox News is faux news is slogan, but, you know, we did used to show both sides of any particular issue, and we strained to do that, and we didn't have pundits back then, so we weren't talking to ourselves. We had actual experts on, and, you know, academics on, and really interesting people on as guests. And they
people actually knew something.
Yeah, they brought something to the table and to the party, but they really don't do that much anymore. It's a shame, but they kind of, to my mind, they kind of waste the air airwaves, and at this point it's cable, but you know, the public trust seems to not be as important as it used to be.
When did that change? Was there a specific time when some sale of the business or something like that, or was it just a gradual process?
I saw it right during the O.J. trial, to tell you the truth. You know, it started to become this sensational tabloid journalism kind of thing, and it really, from that point on, it just went downhill.
They saw the ratings and said, we want to keep those, I suppose.
That's absolutely right.
Yeah.
Mm. But I went from there to TBS, the Turner Broadcasting, and I was the series producer of a documentary series called Portrait of America, which they were lovely hour films that kind of showed the people and the place and the history and kind of wove that all together, 1 hour on each state, with Hal Holbrook as the host, the actor Hal Holbrook. And those were really fun to do and very positive but solutions-oriented. You know, it wasn't a travelogue. It was a lot deeper than that, but it really was a great, great series to work on. And then I did a film called Iran Behind the Veil, which...
Yes, that looks very interesting, yeah.
Yeah, that's the one that people remember. It was the first look inside Iran after the 1979 revolution. So it was... Actually, the footage, most of the footage was shot by an Australian team who had gained the confidence and the trust of the Iranian government under Khomeini. And they were allowed in. They kept getting arrested, even though they were accompanied by, you know, state guides and everything. But they managed to bring back about 40 hours of footage, some of it from the front. The Iran-Iraq war was going on.
Oh, of course, yes. Yeah.
And it landed on my desk in Farsi. And so then we spent 5 months, you know, augmenting it. And at the time, actually, they CNN sent over a young writer who spoke Farsi, and she was really, you know, just wet behind the ears, and her name was Christian Amanpour, who then went on, of course, you know, to
not
become
so wet,
not so wet behind the ears 27 years later or whatever. So we did the Iran in the Name of God and Iran Behind the Veil, one for CNN, one for TBS, and it aired on PBS too. So that was those were the 80s in Atlanta, and then I went on to do other documentaries throughout the 90s, a lot of educational films.
Just wonderful that 50 state. What an amazing, that's almost like a lifetime thing to be able to do such breadth of a show.
It was fabulous. Oh. It was a 5-year series and the best job at the time I could have imagined, you know. We would start out with a meeting with the governor's, you know, the governor's office helping us, and invite 30 or 40 people, leaders from every aspect of the state, Native Americans and ranchers, you know, people from all walks of life. Ask them, if you were making a film, weaving a tapestry about your state, what would you include and why, and who should we see, and what books should we read? And we just, you know, went from there. It was fantastic. We shot in 3 seasons. We had 3 days of helicopter aerials, you know, I mean, it was before cable became cut into so many pieces of the pie, you know. There weren't that many channels, and so they could garner ratings, so therefore they could, you know, put some budget behind things. So
right.
We shot film, and it was fantastic.
It just gave me shivers thinking about such a project. It's lovely.
I was so lucky. Yeah, I was the series producer, and then I made the Montana film and the Massachusetts film, and second unit on Texas.
Wow, fabulous! That, yeah. What an incredible career! That's just up to the '80s we're talking about,
right?
Well, let's just put a little bit of music on for just a couple of minutes and give a couple of announcements. Who we are, and we'll get right back to Louise Vance, and we'll talk some more about her career and the upcoming PBS film and documentary, Seneca Falls. So we'll play a little bit talking about Seneca Falls, less about by a waterfall. By a Waterfall by the Bonzo Dog Doodah Band, and leading into my guest, Louise Vance, who is the director of the new PBS film coming out, Seneca Falls. And let's talk about it. It's how long have you been working on it to bring it to this point?
Well, you know, sometimes I'm embarrassed to tell people how long it's been because it's been so long, but about 11 years. And
oh my goodness.
The reason for that is that independent film is 95% fundraising. Mm. And I didn't quite realize that because I had been a staff television producer and then different organizations had handed me a budget and asked me to make a film. And so I really thought it'd be a pretty easy sell and I would just write a few grant proposals and it would be done. And that was not the case. So I would get, you know, a couple of grants and then I would, you know, do some editing and then we'd run out of money. And, you know, some filmmakers go very deep into debt to make a film and I wasn't going to do that. So I just had to do a pay as you go kind of thing. So, It was all about, I could have finished it in 2 to 3 years, but it was all about the fundraising.
Right. So it sounded like you did the filming first. You did all the basic stock, all the filming, and then...
Yes, and then it was languishing and editing, and then sound mixing is a big step, as well as an original score. And I'm very, very excited to tell people that the score is by Tin Hat. It's by Mark Orton, the incredibly talented composer and performer in what was Tin Hat Trio, and they're now going by Tin Hat. Mm. And they have a really loyal following, and they're fantastic. They're sort of eclectic jazz. And they have a vocalist, Carla Kilstead, who is just extraordinary. And she plays she plays violin and hums on sort of the main theme of the film. We have some other vocalists in there as well. But it's a very wonderful score, and it was an original score, so every cue was, you know, lovingly, you know, worked on.
Was worked to the film. Yeah. Wow.
And we also shot some footage of the young woman in the film 10 years later. So the film follows a teenage theater troupe from the Bay Area who go off to the birthplace of the women's rights movement in America, which is Seneca Falls, New York. And
could you tell people, maybe a lot of people don't know, what happened at Seneca Falls about 100
years ago? About 160, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I certainly didn't know. And the reason I made the film was that I got a mailing one day and I opened it from a women's organization. It said, There's going to be a huge celebration for the 150th anniversary of the Seneca Falls Convention, the birth of the women's movement. And I had not heard one word about this in school. To this day, most people still look at me blankly when I bring up Seneca Falls. They don't know what happened there. And what happened there is that there were two women, Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was a young mother of three at the time, and Lucretia Mott, who was a Quaker from Philadelphia. These two women had met in 1840 at the World Anti-Slavery Conference in London. They had both taken a ship over to London because they were avid abolitionists. Stanton's husband, Henry Stanton, was a big abolitionist. So everyone was working to end slavery. Well, these two women got to the conference in London, and they said to them, and the organizers said, sorry, you're women, you're not allowed in.
Oh my goodness.
So they took a trip across the big pond for nothing.
Like
so,
3 months or whatever it takes to go over.
So they vowed, they hadn't met each other until that happened, but they looked at each other and they vowed that when they got back to the States at some point, they were going to have a convention, or they called it a convention back then. It was really a public protest meeting. Mm. But they were going to call a meeting, a demonstration, if you will, to talk about the rights of women or the lack thereof. And so it took 8 years before they did it. But so what happened that was so historic at Seneca Falls is that in 1848, five women, including these two I mentioned, over tea, they sat and they thought, well, how can we get this meeting going? And they decided to place a newspaper ad.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a small ad in the local paper. They had no idea if anyone was going to show up. As it turned out, 300 people came from all over. And this is a little town, about the size of Sebastopol, 7,000.
Oh, wow.
And people came on horseback and in carriage and on foot, and men and women. And for 2 days, they debated the condition of women. Mm. It was the social, civil, and religious conditions of women. Out of that two-day event actually came a couple of things. One is they rewrote the Declaration of Independence to include that all men and women are created equal. They also listed their sort of grievances in that document. It's called the Declaration of Sentiments. And then out of that also came an alliance with Frederick Douglass, the great orator and former slave. And they worked together for years on universal suffrage after that. But a lot of people think that Seneca Falls was just about the vote. You know, the sort of safe story that people talk about women's rights is the vote.
Oh, the suffrage. Yeah.
Yes, women didn't have the vote. Well, women didn't have a lot more than the vote. And I found out and I was just shocked. For example, they did not own their wages, so they didn't own the clothes on their back. Their husband or father owned their wages. Mm. They could not vote, of course. They could not hold public office, sit on a jury, own property, inherit property. So you think about this, if your father is a wealthy landowner, there wasn't much of a middle class, so you were either in the wealthy class or you were more of a servant, or factory worker, or a farmer. But so if you couldn't inherit property, even if your father was wealthy, you were out of luck.
You were just a chattel, basically.
Yeah, so you still had to marry well, as they say. But if you married, then you were legally dead. So some of these leaders, the early leaders, like Susan B. Anthony, people think that Susan B. Anthony, may have been a lesbian or just wasn't interested in men because she was so busy trying to get the vote for women and things like that. But she had many, many suitors, and she did not want to be legally dead. So she wanted to retain at least some rights that an adult woman had to her own wages once she was emancipated from her father. Mm. So, if you married, that was very bad. The other thing is...
So you became Mrs. John Smith. You didn't exist per se anymore.
You did not exist. That's right. Mm. They also, by custom, they did not speak in public. Women did not speak in public. They, of course, were not allowed to enter a profession. They did not let them in college. The first woman in the United States to go to college was Lucy Stone. She's in the film. One of the girls plays her. And,
okay.
It took her 13 years, and she had to pay for it herself. And, these women, they endured a lot of ridicule. And people used to burn Susan B. Anthony in effigy. as she traversed the country on trains. So there was a lot of hatred toward these women. And, you know, what they had to do was law by law, state by state, statute by statute, they had to overturn the restrictive laws that were on the books.
So it wasn't, they couldn't even attempt it at the federal level. They literally had to do it at the state level.
Yes. So there were, you know, they started in New York State and did all of these campaigns. They got the divorce laws changed. Back then, you could not divorce an abusive husband. Mm. Not only couldn't you divorce him, but if you divorced him, if you ran away from him, the law supported your recapture and return. Does that remind you of anything?
It sure does, yeah. Especially in February.
Yeah. So it was just a really dismal life, frankly. Mm. And women also didn't have the benefit of any kind of contraception, so they had, you know, 18 pregnancies and died, and, you know, it was a really grim life. But out of the Seneca Falls Convention, it was sort of lit a grass fire, and they started having conventions then months later, and then almost every year after that. Same thing was happening in Europe, same thing was happening in England. The 1840s were a lot like the 1960s. It was a whole lot of social ferment and great stuff going on. So it was, you know, they freed half this nation from bonds of legal and social slavery. So they deserve to be remembered, you know.
I would think so, even though it takes such a long time, you know, whether it's slavery. I was just in Greensboro 2 weeks ago where they just opened the International Civil Rights Museum, because that's where the Greensboro Four, who sat at the Woolworths lunch counter, and, you know, even that was in 1960. But it still took, you know, a year before they actually were served at that counter. I mean, it wasn't as if it, like, they were served the next day. You know, it's just incredible what barriers are put up.
Yes, and what persistence it takes to get social change to really happen, you know.
Right.
But it always starts with a few people who say no more.
Right.
You know, I was thrilled that George Galloway was on earlier because he's a truth teller, and these women and men were truth tellers. They just said, you know, the treatment, you know, to leave half of the population out of the public life of the nation and to treat them privately so poorly, it's just not right, and it's got to end. And so, you know, you got to love somebody who's that defiant against convention.
Yes, absolutely. As I say, it's in this world, it's you got to, you know, careful, I say, putting your head over the parapet, you know, of that exposure. People are very brave to do that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, they're brave. In the case of the women of 1848, they literally could have been beaten or killed for their actions. Probably some of them were.
I would imagine, yeah. I'm sure the husbands weren't very pleased when they got home. They heard what happened.
Right.
They were having too much fun.
Right.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, Stanton's father was a judge, Judge Cady, and he came to town. He was living in Massachusetts, but he took a horse and buggy, came to Seneca Falls when he heard what his daughter was up to.
Oh, wow.
And he came to check on her sanity. He thought she'd gone around the bend because she actually was publicly standing in front of a group of people and saying, you know, this is not how we want to be treated. She also, Stanton was this just an incredible writer and thinker. And, you know, she rewrote the Bible. I mean, you know, if somebody tried that today, that would be a really daring thing to do in the climate that we're in politically right now. But she wrote the Woman's Bible, and she also wrote an amazing, beautiful speech. The last public speech she gave was called The Solitude of Self. And she said, you come into this world alone, you leave this world alone, and you need to figure out how to take care of yourself. And that was this radical message, particularly to women who were still essentially only as good as the person they married. You know, that was their fate. But she said, figure it out, ladies. Stand on your own. You're a human, and your personhood is valuable and figured out.
Right. And that's it. Just those, it grew. That's thank goodness what happened.
Yes.
And so how did that link in? How did you get to this story of Seneca Falls, which you've made a new documentary of?
Well, I started to tell you earlier, I'd gotten this mailing that said there was going to be this big celebration. And I thought, I've never heard of this. This is going to change some people's lives who do go to this celebration, the 150th, because it said there's going to be tens of thousands of people from all over the world. It's a week of celebrations in this little town. It was kind of the Olympics of women's rights. I thought, well, I have to go to this. And I, right in that moment, I said, this is a film. Somebody's lives are, you know, many people's lives are going to be changed by their experience. And as a filmmaker, you know, you look for stories of transformation. You look for an arc for your characters. You look for, you know, somebody who's ripe for a change, who needs a change, and then experiences a change. And it's, you know, that's what makes for good viewing. And I thought, who am I going to follow? And at first I had grand plans. I thought, I'm going to follow three different groups and, you know. But then, you know, I started raising money and it was like, no, I think I'll follow one group. But I went on the website and it said Wower Power from San Francisco performing these 3 days on this particular stage. So I went to their I got their phone number and I called them. And that evening they were performing at Yerba Buena outside for a little fundraiser to sort of pass the basket to still try to get money for their trip to Seneca Falls. And I watched their play. They were a theater troupe. And I watched their sort of 40-minute skit. And they completely blew me away. Mm. They're just these powerful San Francisco girls, 14 to 18, a multicultural troupe, so lots of different ethnicities and racial identities. And they just had, I don't know, they were just really, really special. And I thought, oh, I'm gonna go with these girls. So I asked them, you know, can I follow you with a camera? And actually, I hired a professional crew from LA, and it was a 5-woman crew. Hmm. And they said, yeah, come on along. We don't know what you're gonna use it for, but come on along, you know. So
yeah, they didn't know what to expect.
Right. So we trooped off and went to Seneca Falls. You know, shot a little bit before they left and a little after they got back. But primarily, it's a road trip with these wonderful teenage girls who have just really unique and different perspectives on life and on feminism. And they're rowdy and funny. And there's one boy on the trip. We have sort of a mascot. Yeah. He's the brother of one of the girls in the play. And his mom and he and his sister are from Sebastopol, actually. So okay. Ruth Mankin is the mom. And Zara Mankin was in the play. And little Elon is 10 years old at the time. And he's so thoughtful. And he's just funny. He's just kind of, you know, everyone's favorite character in the film. Because he's experiencing this. He's traveling with 17 women. So imagine the poor child. But but he's a great sport about it.
That's great. Now, it's interesting. What is the difference now, do you see, between feminism when you were growing up, you know, 60s and 70s, that original surge, and how young women see it now and how they are with it? Is there much of a difference?
Well, you know, I talk to a lot of young women. I've made several other films about feminist issues. I made 2 films for the National Organization for Women. So I talk to a lot of young women about this. I mean, what I've noticed, and really I'll speak for myself, is that back in the, you know, what they call the second wave of feminism around 1970, there was a kind of in-your-face, a little shouting going on, a little burning of the bras, mm-hmm. and that was all great. I was right there with that, you know. But I don't know, it seems to me now that the young women, particularly in my film, they don't want to pull up a chair to the same table that men have been sitting around and say, hey, can we get in here? Can we elbow our way in and you know, just join your world? Mm-hmm. What they want to do is they want to envision how the world looks to them. Mm. And they want to bring a new kind of energy, their own energy and their own authenticity to the world and to their tasks. And it's a different thing. It's sort of, how do we share your vision, our vision, you know, and include everyone in that? They're very, and as am I, very empowered by the idea that, you know, let's, you know, I always say this, if you took 100 really brilliant people, and you put them in a room, and then you told 51 of them they had to leave because they were women, don't really care what you have to say, and then 12 of them because they were black, and, you know, 3 of them because they were Asian Americans, and then, you know, you're not going to end up with 100 wonderful, you know, contributions to whatever it is you're trying to do. You're going to end up with a very small number. So I think that these young women, and speaking for myself, I'd like to see women not always being on the margins of public and business kinds of decision making. I'm not saying that women should be, obviously, I don't think women should be running the world. I don't think men should be running the world. I think that a shared, you know, unity of all people that have good ideas and all people that want to see the world have more freedom and, you know, be a healthier, more sustainable place to live. I think that everyone should be able to bring those ideas and roll up their sleeves and work hard and make the world a better place. So it's just about bringing people to the table and having enough room for everyone at the table.
Right.
And making a new table if you want to.
Hey, why not? Yeah, we've got some new ones in our new studio here. We love them.
They're very lovely. Yeah.
And so, well, let's now segue. You have this group of girls you did the film about. Now we have a whole other group of girls in Sebastopol who are going to Carnegie Hall, and you have a benefit coming up tomorrow.
Yes, we are going to have a wonderful homegrown event tomorrow night at Annalee High School in the theater. And this is a benefit for 3 things. It's a benefit for the Annalee Theater Arts Program, which is always fantastic. And, you know, they've experienced budget cuts, as all schools have. So the second recipient is the Honor Choir, which, as you say, is going to Carnegie Hall in April. So it's just a fantastic experience awaiting those young people. And they're going to be performing tomorrow night 2 songs as a sort of welcome performance. And also we're just very lucky. We're going to have the mayor of Sebastopol say a few words. That's Sarah Gurney.
Oh, yes.
And then Nancy Dobbs, the CEO of KRCB. KRCB, I have to say, has been a tremendous partner for me. They are the presenting station to the PBS system of our film.
Oh, very good.
And Stan Marvin and Nancy Dobbs and all the folks over there have been fabulous. And, you know, that's the reason it's nationally going to be broadcast, is because of KRCB. They do what they're supposed to do. They serve the public and, you know, they embraced my film and me. And then the third recipient of the benefit tomorrow is the educational outreach campaign for this film, because as someone said to me today, the film is just the beginning. And another way that's been said is, you know, first you have the baby, then you raise the baby. So I need to raise the baby. And by that, I mean, we need to have educational materials developed around it. We need to get it into after school programs with activities. We need to just keep pushing it out into the world.
And not just a one-off thing, but to let people use it as an educational tool.
Yeah. Absolutely. So that's something that we're still, you know, in the fundraising mode for, and we, you know, look for support wherever we can get it. We're writing grants again. But individual support is coming in, and I think when people see the film, they realize that it's crazy that this has been an invisible part of the American history, you know, narrative. I mean, it's just invisible.
Right.
And the power, particularly that young women seem to get from watching this. I mean, it's a sense of pride that there are people that look like me and are like me and were ordinary people like me that shaped the destiny of this country.
Right.
And if they could do it, I can do it, you know? So I think it just gives people a boost in terms of citizen activism and citizen participation in their democracy. And plus, you know, we walk around with all these stories of history. We walk around with, you know, George Washington and, you know, Abe Lincoln, who, you know, was Honest Abe. And, you know, there's people that are, it's in our embedded in our consciousness. And there are these women and men who, you know, did this wonderful, amazing thing, spent 40 or 50 years in, you know, ensuring the rights and opportunities of women. And
even though they didn't see it themselves, that didn't matter. Right. They kept on working to that point.
That's right. There was only one woman at the Seneca Falls Convention. She was 17 at the time. She was a glove maker named Charlotte Woodward. And she lived to cast her vote. She was the only person.
Really?
Yeah. Oh. In 1920.
Oh, amazing. There was that legacy.
Yes.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah. The others didn't make, but they...
Yeah.
And actually, Susan B. Anthony, almost on her deathbed, she said, it just seems so terribly unfair that I didn't live to see it. So she was quite aware, but...
She was the Moses of the... they could see it, but not go in.
That's right. Yeah.
So now tomorrow, when's it starting? Where is it happening, the benefit?
Yes, it's at 7:30, and the doors open at, I believe, 6:30 at Annalee High School. That's Annalee Avenue in Sebastopol. And tickets are available at all Copperfields Books in Sonoma County. They're also available at the door and online. And tickets are $10 for adults, $8 for students and seniors. And then if there's a group of 20 or more, we have some Girl Scouts coming. We have some classes coming. 20 or more students, they can go online and arrange for a $6 price, a group discount. So the information is at annaleechoir.org. That's A-N-A-L-Y, annaleechoir.org. And more information about the film is at senecafallsfilm.org.
Great. Well, I strongly urge everyone to go to it tomorrow. Leave a couple of seats for me. But it looks like it's going to be a wonderful event with some lovely singing beforehand. And I think it sounds like there'll be a pretty good atmosphere going there.
I think it's going to be wonderful. Yeah. Thank you so much, Arnold. Thank you for your interest. And I hope to see you tomorrow night.
Oh, it's a pleasure having you in the studio. And hopefully it's very, very successful. And you do lots of other wonderful documentaries as well.
Thank
in the future.
So much. Thanks.
Thank you. So coming up is Miss Annie. So thank you very, very much, Louise Vance, director of Seneca Falls. So hang on in there. It's another week has gone of Arnaldo's show. So tune in next week. I think it's going to be fairly silly, actually. We'll have an interview with Roger Ruskin Spear, and then lots of silly British comedy and music and things like that. So hang on in there and hang on in for Miss Annie.